ship, an Israeli transport ship that's being planned. Are you a part of that as well?
I am here as we speak, meeting with folks, and it's the same ship, actually, that was in Tacoma. It's I'm not sure of its actual location at the moment, but it's to be in port here in Seattle. And there's definitely a plan to try to discourage the unloading of that ship.
And do you feel, can you talk about the influence of your daughter's work before she was killed in Gaza in inspiring you to take on this mantle of challenging the Israeli oppression of Palestinians?
Oh, you know, Rachel brought her family to this issue, and we have been held in the hearts of so many people through these years and supported and encouraged in the work that we do. It's really the fact, I think, you know, that we've been able to travel to Gaza. Gazans, for the most part, are not able to go, leave there or to return. When they come back, it's so difficult. But Craig and I have been privileged to travel there 5 times. We were there in 2012. As Operation Pillar of Cloud started, we were there twice in 2009 after Operation Cast Lead. And I think when you, I think just to hear about it, but certainly having walked in the rubble and having met with families whose family members were killed and injured during those operations makes it very hard not to, we're just compelled to keep doing what we can do. Rachel talked about making commitments to places, and I think to the extent that we're able to do that, we just continue to be committed to trying to create change in this country and elsewhere that will lead to freedom and equality for the people of Gaza, the West Bank, and all the people in the region.
Your family had a lawsuit against Caterpillar, which is the company that owned the bulldozer that was sold to the Israeli military that ended up killing Rachel in that attack in Rafah, Gaza. Do you still think that boycotting Caterpillar is the way to go? Are you calling for a boycott of Caterpillar?
Yeah. You know, we've been very heartened by decisions that have been made by church communities like the Presbyterian Church and by others to divest from Caterpillar Corporation. Caterpillar is very much implicated. I can guarantee that there are Caterpillar bulldozers that have been at work in Gaza during these last weeks. I've seen the D9 bulldozers that were used at the time Rachel was there. We know that the equipment continues to be sent there, despite the fact that so many people have reached out to Caterpillar and asked them to cease those exports. So I definitely think that they remain a target.
So the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement that Cindy Corey has mentioned is can be found on the web at bdsmovement.net for more information about some of those actions. The port blockade that is currently ongoing, they're moved now from Tacoma to Seattle. More information on that can be found at blocktheboatnw.wordpress.com. That's blocktheboatnw.wordpress.com. Again, I've been speaking with Cindy Corey, the mother of the late Rachel Corey, who was killed in 2003 in Rafah, Gaza. And Cindy has been a part of the port blockade that's been going on in Tacoma this past weekend to try and stop an Israeli ship from docking. Cindy, thank you so much for joining us today on KBOO.
Thank you for your interest. Thanks a lot.
This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News in Depth.
As more and more of our men and women get caught up in the system of mass incarceration, the effect on family members cannot be ignored. Tune in to Prison Pipeline on August 25th at 6:30 p.m. to hear host Amy Johnson speak with members of Mothers of Incarcerated Sons Society. MISS is a group for people who are dealing with the incarceration of a loved one.
The time is 6.04 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next on KBOO, it's Labor Radio. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Oregon State Fair, Dia de la Familia, inviting you and your family to come out on Sunday, August 31st in Salem. A celebration of Latino culture, Dia de la Familia includes live Latin music, food, mariachi, ballet folklorico, face painting, and the Chemeketa Community College women's soccer team at the Kids Kick Camp.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Good evening, this is Jamie Partridge with Labor Radio, and my co-host tonight is John Walsh. We'll be talking in two segments tonight, first about climate jobs, and secondly, about $15 minimum wage, the 15 Now campaign.
How does the labor movement intersect with the movement for climate justice, for improving and protecting the environment? We have a local example in Inner Northeast Portland, where the Musicians Union Hall is installing solar panels on the roof. On Sunday, August 17th, a celebration was held to mark that, and Labor Radio was present to talk with some of the people most involved and experienced in these efforts. We're talking with Dave King, co-chair of the Climate Jobs Committee. Dave, what is the Climate Jobs Committee?
It's a bunch of people that are promoting the jobs that would take to fix the climate, which is millions of jobs.
What type of jobs are we talking about?
People think of climate jobs as being alternative fuels and electric energy, and then maybe weatherization, and that's a lot. That's all important. But there's a lot more than that. We already have a lot of climate problems in the pipeline that are happening. So glaciers are melting. As the glaciers go away, glaciers have served us very well as metering water down to the rivers and keeping our rivers full all summer. When the glaciers aren't there anymore, that ain't going to happen. So we're going to have to figure out some way to hold the rain when it falls and send that down to the rivers to keep them going. Huge job. A lot of mountains, a lot of glaciers need to be replaced. One of the biggest energy users that we have for individuals is flying in airplanes. We kind of stopped that, and the way to do it is with high-speed rail, bullet trains. What's it take to build a high-speed rail line? Quite a bit more than a pipeline, because it has to be flat and on the surface. Just think about, as the sea level rises, all the oil tank farms that are along the river, those big silver tanks, we don't want to get them flooded. They have to be moved uphill. It's all kinds of jobs.
So some of these jobs are manufacturing jobs, some might be installation, some are large industrial setting type jobs, some might be mom and pop.
Agriculture is another thing. As deserts spread and floods happen and destroys big agricultural areas, we need to have a lot more small, local, very quick farms. To be able to pick up the slack when crops fail in other places, in different places. So, that's another huge thing. And that's, the whole infrastructure for small agriculture and farms.
So we have a big climate crisis. We have a major unemployment problem. How do we instigate this solution to both?
Well, I think what we need to do is build a movement. We need to build consciousness. And that's what we're doing here today, is trying to alert people to how bad the climate crisis is. How we're really on the edge of systems failing that will send the climate way out of control.
What do we do about the jobs that are tied up with the carbon economy? Usually one obstacle to getting people to commit to this sort of thing
is that people have a vested interest in the way things are.
Yeah.
How do we talk to coal miners and oil field workers and people otherwise invested in carbon?
Really important question. Yeah, we've got, that's one of the things we've got to do, is we've got to make it so that people are not going to be hurt. It'll be better for people, because we need to be creating good jobs, not lousy jobs. And you know, and we can retrain people. Some of the fossil fuel industry workers are going to have to keep on going until we get the alternatives up.
So the Climate Jobs Committee is in Portland, is that right?
Yeah.
So how do we take this more broadly? How do we get it to be statewide, nationwide, international?
We're doing it now on KBOO.
Right, that's one step. Communicate, right?
Yeah, all right, KBOO.fm, right?
Thank you.
That's one way. We hope to make this a media event in some of the alternative media. Labor Notes, I hope, will be covering it, the labor press. And that's what we have to do. We have to get it out there so other people know about it and other people do it.
So set the example, essentially, right?
Right, and inspire people to do the work.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How long have you been working with the Climate Jobs Committee so far?
I think it's about 2 years.
Uh-huh. So it's a pretty new initiative.
Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah, and we started by reading Bill McKibben's article in the Rolling Stone, The New Math of Climate Change, The Terrifying New Math of Climate, or something like that. And that inspired, about 16 people read the article, and then we met to talk about it, and out of those 16 people, 12 of us decided we wanted to form a committee. So that's what kicked off the committee.
Now, if people hear this and want to get involved, want to pitch in, what should they do?
They can call me at 503-286-5850, or they can email me at LANDD_2@Q.com.
And we'll post those that number and that email address with the
Great. With
the show here, so people who didn't have a pencil ready will still have it. We're talking to Dave King, co-chair of the Climate Jobs Committee. We're at the Musicians Hall, where the solar installation is almost good to go.
Yep.
So we're talking with Bruce Fife, who's the president of Musicians Local 99. And Bruce, tell us about this event today. What's going on here?
Well, we are celebrating what is supposed to be a solar array unit going on the building on the roof of Local 99 here. So there's a group of advocates called the Climate Jobs Committee that approached us thinking this would be a good location for this. And over the last almost year and a half, we've been working to get to this point. It's not quite there. The panels are on the roof, though not installed yet. We're still waiting for permits from the city, but it looks like we're there and it's a go, and that they will be installed by within a week.
So I understand from what you just said, this is a complicated process.
It's been a very complicated process. It started out, it's a lottery to begin with, so the tax incentive is a feed-in tariff for putting solar on your roof that's out there, and it's a lottery to get picked. So we lost in the lottery initially coming out of the chutes, and that kind of created a disbanding of the group at that point. And then 2.5-3 months later, they came back and said, just kidding, you guys are now in. So we had to kind of put it all back together at that point, which was made it much more complicated.
From the standpoint of the local, I mean, what's the perspective of the local on doing this? What was the appeal to the members?
Well, the long-term appeal is that with the investor we have on it, after about 7 years, well, we get reduced or free virtually electricity for, you know, the upcoming time period, depending upon how sunny it is and all those kinds of things.
Free is a good thing.
Free is a good thing. Sending electricity back to the grid. But after, I believe it's 7 years, then the investor will have gotten his return on investment. He sells it back to us for a dollar or something along those lines. And so for the next 20 years, we will be, you know, paying or shipping electricity into the grid.
And getting money back.
And getting free electricity, and yeah. So it's a long-term financial advantage as well as being, you know, good for the environment.
Okay, so that's a good thing. So the local actually will, at least in the long run, make money off of this, receive revenue from it.
Yeah.
As well as setting a good example for others as far as being responsible environmentally.
Absolutely.
What would you say to other people looking at this or other unions? I mean, what's your advice from this experience?
I would hope that the challenges we faced are challenges faced by somebody the first time through, and that it would be easier next time through, and so on and so forth. But I think, you know, I'm not sure exactly what the status of the feed and tariff program is, whether that will continue, because that's the big financial incentive to invest the money in it to do it. So as long as that continues and you got the roof space or the ability to do it and you know, the available cash on hand to be able to finance it, it makes all the sense in the world to me.
So you guys have climbed the learning curve. Hopefully other people can benefit from that experience.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, thank you for setting a good example and for doing something that helps out not only the members of this local, but also the planet. Thanks.
Absolutely. Thanks.
Okay.
We're talking with Barbara Byrd, Secretary Treasurer of the Oregon AFL-CIO. And Barbara, you've been following this intersection of climate and labor for quite some time, both at the state and national and international level, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I have. When Tom Chamberlain and I were elected to our positions at the Oregon AFL, we started the Oregon Apollo Alliance for the reason of bringing together labor and environmentalists to talk about how to deal with the climate crisis and at the same time create good union jobs. And so we've seen it all along as both a way to help the environment and also help the economy and try to make sure that we don't lose union jobs, that we create new ones, and that we bring people out of poverty and into those jobs when we can.
Do you see key factors in making that happen and having these new jobs be good jobs, be union jobs?
Well, it is definitely not automatic. You definitely have to have policies in place that require employers to do the right thing. And that's a lot of the work that the Apollo Alliance has been doing in Oregon and what we'll continue to do in February when the carbon tax measure is being considered.
So putting those policies into environmental legislation and vice versa.
Yeah. I mean, the Apollo folks always used to call it tying blue strings.
Having followed this for some time, are you seeing trends happening either locally or more widely in this relationship?
The relationship between labor and environmental?
Yes.
You mean?
Yeah,
unfortunately, I think that the trend has been lately, especially in Oregon, that there's way more issues that divide us than bring us together. It's much harder doing this work now than it was when we got started 7-8 years ago. Coal export terminals and LNG terminals and the Columbia River crossing and West Haven Island. I mean, I could just go on and on of all
right.
the issues that keep labor and environmentalists from sitting down together and having a civil conversation. It's been very difficult lately.
Sounds like part of that might be because so many building trades jobs are tied up with carbon-related facilities and there's not an alternative set of facilities. Is that
I think that partly it's true, but I also think that the environmental community doesn't consider the impact that their proposals are going to have on jobs, and in so doing they kind of alienate. It's not just the building trades. They alienate workers in manufacturing. They alienate people in my position that want to try to keep the labor movement together. I mean, it's very difficult right now.
How do we get past that? What's the way to get people to start having the bigger view?
Yeah, well, all I know is we have to keep talking. We have to keep trying to, and that's why I keep working on this blue-green Apollo stuff, is we have to be at the table together, having the conversations, even if they're hard, and we have to find places that we can work together. We have to find projects like this one at the Musicians Hall, where helping the environment is going to create a few good jobs. We have to find a way to come together around bigger policy issues like the carbon tax that's going to be heard by the legislature in the next session. We have to find ways to compromise and reach some common positions that will help us move that bill forward in a way that works for everybody. And it's not going to be easy, but I think there's people on both sides that want to try to make that happen. We just have to keep plugging away at it because it's so important to deal with the issue.
So a realistic but undefeated view from Barbara Byrd. Thank you, Barbara.
For more information about the Climate Jobs Committee in Portland, call Dave King at 503-286-5850.
That was John Walsh at the Musicians Hall celebration of their solar installation and climate jobs. This is KBOO Portland. You're listening to Labor Radio, and this is Jamie Partridge. In the second segment, we'll be hearing about 15 Now, PDX. Good evening. This is Jamie Partridge with Labor Radio. I'm here with Justin Norton Kirsten, one of the leaders of 15 Now, PDX, the fight for a $15 minimum wage, and with Seamus Cook, who's a leader in SEIU Local 503, service employees. So, Justin, we've been looking at an amazing development of this fight for $15 minimum wage movement across the country for the last 2 years, starting with a wave of strikes by fast food workers, and then more recently this amazing election victory in Seattle with Shama Sawant, the socialist candidate for city council, winning on a $15 minimum wage platform. And here in Portland, the movement has really been kicked off by the Nick Caleb campaign for city council in last spring, in which $15 minimum wage was a main campaign platform. What's been going on with 15 now PDX since then, Justin?
Well, we've been doing a lot of work since then. Right now, sort of our main push is working on the city council to raise the minimum wage to 15 for city contractors and city workers. Those are two of the main areas that the city council can take action on, considering the state's minimum wage preemption law.
What is the state's preemption law?
It's a law that was passed, I believe, in 2002 by the state legislature that prevents cities and local municipalities from raising the minimum wage beyond what the state has set it at.
The city of Portland is not able to do what the city of Seattle recently did, which is to directly raise the minimum wage to 15. And so you're pushing the city to raise the wage for workers who work for companies who contract with the city. And there's a specific policy. And what are you doing about that?
We've been talking with workers that work for contract companies, and we're holding a hearing on October 20th. It's going to be at the SEIU 49 Union Hall, and that's going to be a hearing on the City of Portland's fair wage policy. City commissioners have been invited to attend. There's going to be testimony by workers who are affected by the fair wage policy and other allies. And basically, we're going to, you know, put the issue right in front of the city councilors and talk about it and ask them to respond and really push them to do the right thing.
And what kind of workers are affected by this fair wage policy?
So these are people like janitors, security guards, parking attendants, people who work for companies that are private companies, but that, you know, the city pays the companies to do work for the city, basically.
And there are also city workers that actually work for the city who make less than $15 an hour.
Right. So, you know, parks workers, maintenance workers, things like even administrative staff, things like that. You know, there's thousands of city workers, and a lot of them aren't making $15 an hour. You know, Amanda Fritz herself made quite a point of the fact that so many city workers in her department alone don't make $15 an hour, that it would cost a couple $1 million a year in order to raise their wage to that level.
So you're going to need quite a movement to even move the city to raise the minimum wage for the contracted workers and certainly for the city workers.
Yeah, definitely. And that, you know, that's one of the main points of this hearing, is really to get the community involved, outreach to the workers who are affected and to people who are allies of those workers, and really start building a grassroots workers movement that can pressure city council to act.
So who are you reaching out to get support for this campaign?
Well, like we said, city workers specifically. We've been talking to parking lot attendants, and we're going to be talking to janitors and security guards around town as well, as well as local unions who maybe represent workers who are in a contract position or not, or you know, just other labor allies.
And how does this affect other labor allies, people who are in unions who might not be contract workers, or why is this important to them?
Well, it's important to them because, you know, the other preemption exception is that the city council can raise the wage for all city workers. And if we can pressure them to do it for contractors, for these private companies, you know, if our tax dollars are going to go to be raising the wage for employees of private companies, then certainly our tax dollars should go to raise the wage for city workers.
Well, a lot of these workers, the janitors, the security guards, the parking lot attendants, used to be public employees, and the city council, in order to save money, contracted with companies that pay people less. And so if they raise the wage for these contract workers, there's no incentive to be contracting them out, and why not bring them back in as public employees?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point. And you know, that's a big problem that's been going on for a long time. And so that's something that really needs to be addressed, and hopefully this hearing and the wage issue will help start to address that.
So that's October 20th. At the SEIU Local 49 Union Hall, fair wage policy hearing. Great. And what about this preemption law? What are you trying to do about that?
Yeah, so in order to raise the wage for all workers in any city, we have to work around that preemption law. So rather than waste time at the state just trying to repeal the preemption law, and then only to have to go back and go piecemeal city by city raising the minimum wage. We're at the point where we're just going to start trying to push for a whole statewide raise in the minimum wage. We've started talking with people throughout the state. We've got chapters forming in Beaverton and a new chapter starting in Eugene, and we're going to be spreading beyond that and really start building across the state the infrastructure that's going to be necessary to really push this at a statewide level.
Besides the preemption law, what was it about the movement catching on that caused you to decide to go statewide at this point?
Well, a meeting was recently held at the AFL-CIO hall between Diane Rosenbaum, the state Senate Majority Leader, Brad Avakian, who's the state labor commissioner, with the AFL-CIO and some other unnamed unions and nonprofit groups, basically to strategize for how to get the minimum wage raised through the state legislature. And they basically made it very clear that 15 is way too high, and that's not going to be the number, probably somewhere more around 11 or 1150. And so if that's going to be the case, then we really need to start putting pressure on them to do the right thing. If they're going to raise the minimum wage in the state legislature, it needs to be 15.
And why is it important to go for 15? Something like the rent's too high, or?
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, last year or at the beginning of this year, our minimum wage increased by 10 cents, 1.5%, because our minimum wage is attached to the national rate of inflation. But the rate of inflation in Oregon and Portland has been raising at much, much higher than that over the last few years. Inflation in general was over 3% here in 2013, and rent went up by 6% in 2013. And really just 11, 12, even 13 is not enough. 15 is barely enough. According to the National Low-Income Housing Coalition, in the city of Portland, in the state of Oregon, a minimum wage worker who is a single parent has to work 72 hours per week in order to be able to afford adequate housing. If she only wants to work a full-time 40-hour week, then she has to make at least $16 an hour. So the idea that 11 or 1150 or even 12 or 13 is going to be enough to help people in our state really get their heads above water is kind of a joke.
And now the fair wage policy of the city of Portland is pegged at $10.38 an hour, which is with a $1.98 benefit. So that's not there yet. I want to turn now to Seamus Cook, who as a member of SEIU Local 503 has been active in pushing for the minimum $15 minimum wage. Seamus, why don't you give us a little background about SEIU's role in this fight, both nationwide and then bring it back to Oregon?
Well, what's interesting is that SEIU more or less started this whole campaign, this demand, by themselves. In November 2012, they started organizing with fast food workers in different cities, and that was when there was the first fast food strikes, and they demanded 15 in a union. So that kicked it off right there into the public consciousness about this demand, and it was totally labor-led. So it shows, I think, the power of a union when they put forth inspiring demands and they really agitate working class people and towards achieving something great. After that, SEIU, the big victory in Seattle, SEIU 775 played a key role in that, working with Shama Sawant and sometimes butting heads with her group in Seattle. And then I think even more impressively is SEIU 1021 in San Francisco, who led the charge towards a ballot initiative for a $15 minimum wage, which gets voted on in November. So back to Oregon. In Oregon, SEIU, I think, has been lagging a bit behind their southern sister unions. So we're trying to make sure that they engage in the fight here, too. Recently at our convention, SEIU 503 voted to endorse 15 now PDX, as well as a resolution. The same resolution includes making SEIU engage in the struggle to take away the preemption law that Justin mentioned, as well as agreeing to the idea of a ballot initiative. Actually, there's more teeth in that in the resolution. It talks about joining with community allies and unions to put forth the ballot initiative.
So SEIU Local 503 is looking at a statewide ballot ballot initiative. Do we know when we'd be talking about? Is that 2015, 2016? Do we know?
At this point, we don't know any details about anything. The resolution was just passed this past Saturday. So, you know, there's been no planning, as far as I know, from the leadership's perspective.
Okay, so we've got a number of different balls in the air here. We've got a a city fair wage policy, trying to raise the wage to 15 for the contracted workers of the city of Portland. We've got city of Portland workers, people who are working directly for the city, who need a $15 minimum wage. We're talking about eliminating a preemption law at the state legislature and a statewide ballot initiative. How can local people who want to get involved, I mean, what kind of activities are you involved, are you doing that people can plug into, Justin?
Well, right now our main focus has been on putting together the hearing on October 20th, as well as another forum on labor unions and the fight for 15 that we're putting on in November. But, you know, we did a lot of the Living Wage Wednesday rallies, and we're still doing rallies here and there, but we're sort of more focusing at this point in Portland on specifically things that we can do to engage the low-wage workers and really organizing them and getting their voices heard.
I hear there might be something going on October 1st.
A rally at City Hall October 1st at 4:30 p.m. In support of our fair wage policy.
Is there a website, a phone number, a Facebook page? Help me out here.
Yeah, so you can go to 15nowpdx.org. That's our website where we keep information up to date. We've got a calendar there on the front page and everything. We've got a Facebook page. You just type in 15nowpdx into Facebook and find that there. There's another sort of corollary Facebook page that's a Fight for 15 or PDX that also gives a lot of good information. You can email us at info@15nowpdx.org. We'll shoot you whatever information that we have and updates that we have.
Great. Thanks very much, Justin Norton Kirsten and Seamus Cook. That wraps it up for Labor Radio for this Monday and every Monday, the only show of its kind in Oregon or Southwest Washington, of the working class, by the working class, for the working class. This is Jamie Partridge, your co-host. I want to thank Danielle Parks, our engineer. And before we sign off, I want to make an announcement about the Oregon Fair Trade Campaign's 10th year anniversary dinner, celebrating 10 years of fighting for trade justice.